Okay, shall we start? Before we start this lecture on strategic litigation, I just wanted to check with you. Yesterday and the day before, I posted some links to my presentations on the group, on the Facebook group, and somehow links has disappeared. I don't know if you were able to access them. If you have any problems, I just posted the new these links, so you can access the previous presentations.
No, there is your old link.
Sorry?
It is still there. The one that you posted yesterday at 11.
It is there. It's in there? Because some people from some computers, they cannot be accessible. From my computer, they are accessible. Then, what is the reason?
So you're talking about the one that you posted yesterday or today?
Yesterday. Are they available from your computer?
Yeah. From yesterday is accessible, but two of them that you posted today, they are not accessible.
An hour ago.
They are not accessible.
Yeah.
That is an hour ago.
Okay. There are problems with the Facebook. Anyway, we'll fix it. So yesterday we were talking about European Convention and its application, implementation in Russian courts. And today and today, tomorrow, we will speak about particular cases of domestic application of the Convention, and not only about the Convention, but in general. Mostly we will speak about these cases from the point of view of strategic litigation of those cases. What is strategic litigation from your point of view? What is the difference between litigating case or number of cases strategically and from regular case?
If you want to litigate strategically, you have to pick cases that will succeed.
Okay. You have to pick cases, a number of cases, from the point of view that you can win.
Yes.
Okay. Are there other opinions? To win what?
Just
to win? Like no, in Olymp- no, just no. In like in the Olympics, I won. That's
no,
it.
No, must be any purpose. Not to win like a great set. Case, but reaching some goal, like bringing the convention to the courts and making them apply it.
Okay, so there should be a purpose, not just to win the case, not just to give a remedy to a particular victim, a client.
Yeah, but in order to reach the purpose, you need to strategically pick those cases that will.
So you have a purpose, let's say, to bring to the attention of judges the European Convention, direct application of the Convention. And you pick cases which can somehow tackle this issue. Right? And you have to have not just one case, but a number of cases. Or if you want, if your NGO is dealing with the issue of access to buildings of wheelchair disabled people. So you pick cases which can draw attention of the state organs on this particular problem. It might be one case, but very interesting. It can be a number of cases, but tackling the problem from different sides. So today we'll speak about this these cases. Maybe one case, maybe a number of cases, where the strategic cases are coming from, which sources, and we will speak about particular cases and how they developed from one case to another. So, strategic cases. It's all about this purpose. The purpose that you can achieve, but you cannot do it by working on just maybe one case, or you work on this case, but not just as a lawyer, but also as a journalist, as a researcher. It's not about legal tools that you use, but you also use different tools of PR. You promote the idea of this case through different sources. You organize maybe conferences, press conferences, roundtables, and it's all included into the tools to conduct strategic litigation. So when NGO or somebody else is, well, first of all, where are those cases are coming from? How an NGO pick a case? Where when I started to work at the NGO, couldn't quite understand why we're doing this or this, why we're picking up this case, why we're organizing a press conference, or why do we do something else. But then later on, I realized that it was done in order to achieve this bigger point, bigger aim, goal, and to do it strategically from different sides. So, of course, we were looking for the cases were born from victims, how we call it, from victims to problems and cases. So it's a usual situation when a victim, a client, comes to your office, share a story, and you see, here's the case, let's work in this case. And this is the examples, like Bugrova case. It's a person who just walked into our office and shared what happened to her husband. It can be like internet communication, like Mikhailova case. Mikhailova, she lives in St. Petersburg and happened to come to the NGO website and fill out this form asking for consultation, legal consultation. And we found out that her case, her legal problems are very much interesting and concern not just her, but many other people, and we started to work on her cases, and I will mention later her cases. It can be our friends, like Arbuzova and Minin. Arbuzova, I mentioned that in the beginning NGO started, worked on mostly labor cases. And Arbuzova was, Yelena Arbuzova was the head of a labor union in one of the towns in Southwest Oblast. She was very active in organizing labor strikes, and at some point she got a phone call from somebody who called himself a prosecutor, asking to come to the prosecutor's office. And of course she didn't come. There was no a document called Povestka notice to come to an office of a prosecutor. But later on she got a she was called to the court, and the court accused her in not following the orders of the prosecutor to come to the office of the prosecutor. And it was an administrative offense, quite serious. And the judge fined her for a number of thousand rubles, which was a big sum for just a worker and labor union activist, a single mother. So, and it was absolutely ungrounded. The judge just organized the hearing and issued this fine. Later, when we started wanted to appeal this fine, we realized that according to the administrative code of the Russian Federation, he could not appeal a judgment of the court, which put on you administrative fine. So there's no right to appeal. The court issued a fine, and that's it. You have to pay. There's no other way. So of course, the only way to help the client was to go to the court, which will consider the legality, constitutionality of the federal law, administrative code. So we went to the Constitution Court of Russia, filed a complaint saying that this particular provision, which does not allow a person to challenge the decision of the court to file an appeal, violates the right to a fair trial. And we also invoked the European Convention. So the Constitutional Court accepted this case quite quickly, actually. Within 6 months, this case was considered, and together with some other applications of similar nature. So we ended up with a judgment of the Constitutional Court, which cancelled this provision of the Administrative Code. And actually, this led to a reform of the administrative law. A couple of years later, in 2002, this case took place in 1998, 1999, and in 2002, Russia issued a new code of administrative offenses. And were already introduced two levels of consideration of the case, on the first instance and then cassation. And it was all due to this case, Arbuzov. So this is a very good example of just a regular person, regular citizen, an activist of labor union, who influenced Russian law so much, introduced just an extra level of protection, cassation instance in all the administrative cases. And actually, the Constitutional Court in this case referred to the European Convention, Article 6, but without mentioning any case law. So, this is how we found started a strategic case which challenged introduced a huge reform to the Russian law from our friend, from our not just client but friend, and how this strategic case before the Constitutional Court grew up from a regular case on administrative offense. Some cases were found from our colleagues, like this case of Bakhrakh. It's quite a interesting case. Bakhrakh is a very famous Russian scholar of administrative law. He was my lecturer in the law school, and later on he was my supervisor of the postgraduate thesis of candidatska dissertatsiya. It was at the time, it was 2001, I think. It was the time when at the airport you could bring a bottle of anything to the plane, open or closed, it doesn't matter. Was before these rules, when you enter the plane, you have to give up all the liquids, more than 100 milliliters. So Bakhrakh once went to a vacation. He was flying from Yekaterinburg to Moscow to visit his daughter and her husband, and he brought a bottle of Hennessy, a small bottle as a present. And it was in 2001, it's quite a fancy present. So when he was entering going through the security to get on the plane, three security persons removed his bottle from him, his bottle, and gave him a piece of paper, sort of a document, which states that they expropriated this bottle because it was prohibited and dangerous. So, and there were three signatures below this document. And he was shocked. Imagine, professor of administrative law was completely tricked during this security. Later he called me and said, come over, we have an interesting case. And he explained to me this situation. He said, I want to see these guys. There was nothing in the rules that you were not allowed to bring any liquid on the plane. It was totally allowed. But somehow these guys, three security guys, decided to take this bottle of weak cognac. The most interesting thing was in this paper at the end, there was a sentence saying that we destroyed this bottle of cognac and three signatures below. Do you understand this? In Russia, there is this thing that you drink everything three persons together. So we brought this case to the district court, and it took about a year, two hearings, to win this case. And it was I don't know what you think about the importance of this case, but I think it was important in two ways. First of all, a professor of administrative law who was usually working, giving lectures, not the practitioner, when he was like 70 years old, he realized how sometimes administrative law works, or doesn't work actually. And it was important for him to win this case, to realize it, and he was so happy to appear before the judge and then to work on the execution of this case. He was actually awarded an amount of money equal to the cost of the bottle and moral damages. And second of all, it was interesting to look at the security guys, the personnel who was represented, who was acting on behalf of the airport. They were feeling as if nothing special happened. They removed somebody's property and it was fine. Why not? It's all.
But is this a civil case then?
It is a civil case, yes.
How is it possible? Why didn't you try to meet in the lady to do this administrative case? Because they were working on behalf of the authorities. I mean, three men. They were working, mm-hmm. and they are representing, Mr. Orban.
What do you mean by administrative case? There was a case about somebody removed somebody's property.
Yeah, but who was the one?
I think it means that why, for example, you cannot file a suit, not a suit, but a special complaint in accordance with chapter and remember.
Okay, I understand. To complain about illegal activity of administrative
officials.
Yes.
Well, first of all, they were not public officials. They were, what is it, private. They were not even the police.
Okay.
They were a security team attached to the airport, which is a private company.
The airport is a private company?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't know.
But also, the point of this lawsuit was not to. So, of course, you can go different ways. Maybe there was an opportunity to go this way as well. But we didn't think about it, and we wanted to punish the airport with the money. sometimes it's a better punishment for them to start to think, but you can't really do it. And journalists love this case because it was about a bottle, and there's two, three men who destroyed the bottle. I hope they enjoyed it. Sometimes we go from a problem to a case to a victim. It's actually quite difficult to find a good client. What do I mean by a good client? A client, a victim who would not give up in the middle of the road. Sometimes cases take a lot of time, like 5-7 years right now, if you go to the European Court. It's not even just about the time, it's about you actually have to work on this case. It's not only lawyer who is working on this case. You have to go to a hearing sometimes. If this case is about the death of your husband, each time you think about this case, you think about your husband, right? It reminds me all the time, and it's mentally difficult for a person. Sometimes people can think, oh, I had enough, 2-3 years of this case. And you don't want this to happen because you invested so much effort and time into working on this case, which you understand can lead to very important changes in the law, in the practice. This person might not understand it. And some victims, they're just afraid. And quite often, they come and share what is the violation. But then when you suggest that you can do this, this, and this, and this, you can sue this, and this, and this authorities, and then this person say, you know what, I have business, I have my reputation, I don't want to do this. I just informed you about this problem, maybe you can do something about it. So quite often we go from a victim, from a problem to look for a victim who might be involved in this case, in this case. For example, this case, Book of First Treasure, that's my case. Why I decided to do this case? 2 years ago, one of the universities in Katrenburg invited a law professor from France. And when they were doing all this paperwork to employ this person for 1 year of lecturing at the university, they realized that they have to pay taxes, income taxes for this person, not 13% as usual. This is a regular tax, income tax. Rate, 13%, 1/3. And they realized that a foreigner, according to the Russian law, a university which hires a person have to pay this tax. They have to pay 30% income tax for a foreigner. This is a huge issue. It's not about just extra 17%, it's about motivating people to come to Russia and teach, to share. Like if I want Lowry to come to a Russian university and participate in this kind of summer school in Katrenburg, like next week, which will happen in Katrenburg, I have to invite him for free, or if I have some funds to pay, it's minus of his salary, potential salary. So we suggested this person, let's have a lawsuit, let's file a case to the Constitutional Court, challenge the tax code of the Russian Federation. And for some reason this person didn't want to do this. It can be maybe he was afraid of not getting a visa next time to come to Russia, or it's just a lot of work.
I think to my mind it could not be a prospective case in the constitutional court with this one. If you go to the constitutional court to say that this is this very large rate and so on.
I will come to this. So when I heard about this situation, I remembered that just a year ago, year before that, when I was studying at Cambridge, I was coming to Russia to give lectures. Actually, Bakhrat invited me to give lectures at the local university. And I went there for a couple of weeks, and we gave lectures, and then I was given a salary, and I realized that it's my salary minus 30%. I said, why? And the accountant said, well, because you are a non-resident of Russia. You are a Russian citizen, but you are non-resident in terms of paying taxes. You have to pay 30%. I was wondering, at that time I was so busy with my thesis and finishing it, but when we faced the same problem with the foreigner, I remember the situation. I thought, that's very strange. I'm a Russian citizen living abroad for a while because I'm studying. Another person is a Russian citizen too, but working, studying in the university in Russia. And I have to pay 30% and this person has to pay 13%. Why? Why is the discrimination? It's just because I'm placed for a while outside of Russia? So we felt there was no way, there was no point to go to a district court, like to file a lawsuit against the law school which paid me a salary, because the problem is in the law, in the tax law, tax code. So we went to the Constitutional Court, filed the complaint. And then, of course, Constitutional Court, of course, I don't know, to get a rejection. The reason was that basically it's up to the state to put 13% or 30%. But according to the European Convention, it's up to the state, of course. Sovereignty is very important. But if you discriminate somebody, give a reason. Why? Is it because of the security of the state? Is it because of the economic reasons? Or give a reason. It's actually the same situation in Martin versus Russia. The European Court blamed the Constitutional Court not because of the discrimination, but mostly because the Constitutional Court didn't give any reasons, any justification why Martin was discriminated.
But he must not do it, I think, to my mind, because the European Court of Human Rights said that the Constitutional Court had to provide any statistical data in this decision, but he must not do it, because they, in this point, I absolutely agree with President Zorkin when he said that this statistical information is obtained during the legislation process when the parliament decides to balance some interests, for example, and when the parliament decided this interest is higher and more important than that interest, they get this information in, for example, in psychology or in social matters.
Where is it? The protocol?
Where what?
Where is this information?
This information, I don't understand what you mean. I mean that just that the Constitutional Court must not provide this information because it presumes that this information was used during the legislation process.
Well, I wouldn't agree with this point ever. Because for some reason we think that if the court gives the reasoning, the judgment, it doesn't have to explain. All our judgments are so short. There's no explanation why the court decided this way. Why Constitutional Court deciding that there is no discrimination and not giving any reasons?
Yes, I agree with you partly because it's about that's our decision, for example, under a shock of the Constitutional Court, and they are very poor. You are absolutely right, because, for example, in Lithuania, the average length of the decision of the Constitutional Court is 50 or 70% pages, and sometimes 150 pages, of course. But I mean that in this case, the Constitutional Court could only deal with the formal and legal side of this question. And when it was the argument of the party that it's not correct balance of the interest and why is it so, the Constitutional Court said that it is not obliged to estimate whether it is correctly socially orientated. Socially oriented this case. It was just a will of the parliament to decide that it was a positive discrimination, probably, to decide that the female do have this parental leave, and it was positive discrimination. And why? The European Court of Human Rights actually wrote in this decision that the Constitutional Court must provide some information according to the number of men servants and the number of female servants in the Russian army, and some information about who care about children in Russian Federation, mostly men or mostly women, and so on. And this information must not be provided by the Constitutional
Court. Okay. Well, that's your point of view. And
in this case, is probably.
In following this point of view, you can say the State Duma can issue a law saying that only wheelchair disabled people have no access to courts because they are. That's it.
It's not a positive discrimination. It's a case of direct restriction.
Let's say legislator can say, okay, all the wheelchair disabled people can have access to court only through a website, web link, video link.
But in this case,
and no justification why.
Can I just put you one question? Are you really sure that it's written down in your text law 30% for a foreigner or 30% for a non-resident? Because that makes a huge difference.
At that time,
you were probably studying in for a year or a longer time in the UK. And you were a non-resident at that time, which doesn't make you automatically a foreigner for the Russian Federation.
I think there are two provisions,
okay,
about foreigners and about non-resident Russians.
So is there a literal provision which states that it's, 30% for a foreigner in your tax law?
Not in tax code.
Tax code.
Foreigner.
Yes. Foreigner.
And non-residents Russians.
Mm-hmm. Both foreigners.
Both. Two different provisions. Okay. Then makes sense for your question.
So, continuing talking about this case. Of course, getting rejection from the Constitutional Court. It took actually a while, for a year maybe. We sent the case to the European Court, saying that there was a violation of the right to property, 17% extra the state removes from the person, plus Article 14, discrimination. Of course, there are doubts whether tax law case can actually be heard by the European Court of Human Rights. We did some research on this issue, and there are hopes that it can be acceptable by the European Court. But the interesting thing is that when, I suppose, stretch here again, when we put all the materials on the website, the application to the European Court was tried in English. But still, many people from outside of Russia who are either on long business trips in a foreign country or found a job outside of Russia, but they're still Russian citizens, they started to, especially in April this year when
they were about to file documents to the Texas service about their taxes, income. We started to receive many emails, letters, saying that, oh, I'm in the same situation. I wanted to sell my house in Russia. And if I sell it, I have to pay 30% instead of 13% income tax. If I sell a house, if I sell a car, I get income and I have to pay. Well, why should I pay 30% instead of 13%? And then, so it's about selling, it's about getting a salary from the source in Russia, you have to pay this amount of tax. So more and more people are joining this lawsuit, this application before the European Court of Human Rights. And we also find more and more cases from one case can lead to another case, and maybe many other cases. And I will give you some examples of this. Zakharkin versus Russia. It's a case before the European Court of Human Rights. It was considered in 2010. Basically, this case is about torture, allegations of torture in prison, an allegation of inhuman degrading treatment in prisons in CISO. Zakharkin was accused of a very serious crime. Anyway, it was an interesting case in terms of that he was claiming that he was tortured in a CISO, in a prison, to extract recognition that he committed a crime. But at the end, it was not proven that Zakharkin was actually tortured. So there was no decision, judgment by the European Court. And then Zakharkin, he was sentenced to a life sentence. And if you're sentenced for life, you put a special prison with a particular regime where for the first 10 years you are not allowed to prolong meetings with your family members. For example, if Zakharkin has a wife, for the first 10 years of imprisonment, he cannot be with her like in the same room. Like stay overnight, have this opportunity. It's only meeting through a screen. So for them, for the Zakharkin, it meant that they could not conceive a child. And after 10 years, probably his wife will not be able to do so. So they wanted to complain about the violation of Article 8, right to private life. Unfortunately, this case didn't result in anything because they divorced finally. But this case led to another interesting case, which was later implemented in case of Borisov versus Russia. So Zakharkin had a representative, an advocate. In the criminal proceedings. But when Zakharkin decided to go to the European Court, a lawyer from an NGO started to represent his interests. This lawyer had not a status as an advocate. He was a regular lawyer from an NGO. And because this person was first in CISO and then in the prison, according to the Russian law, Russian Code of Criminal Procedure, only advocates has an absolute right to just to go to the prison and see the client. If it's not an advocate, it's up to the judge to decide to give a permission or not to give a permission. So our lawyer from an NGO who represented Zakharkin tried to see him in CISO and in prison, to
work on the application before the European Court, and the judge would not allow to do so, would not give permission to go to the prison and see the client. So it resulted into a judgment of the European Court, I think Article 34, if I'm not mistaken. The European Court ruled that this was an obstacle for Zakharkin to file a complaint before the European Court of Human Rights. The right to file an individual complaint before the European Court, which incorporates the right to a representative. So it means that every applicant before the European Court of Human Rights has a right to see, to meet with a its representative, his representative, despite the fact that it's a lawyer, advocate, or not a lawyer. Everybody has a right to meet with his or her client. So, and then it was in 2010, in June, and then in July, I had a client, Borisov, who was also in CISO. And I was preparing his application before the European Court of Human Rights, and I needed to see him in CISO. So I wrote an application to the judge referring to the case of the Zakharkin versus Russia, attached the translation of the judgment, and I got a permission from the judge, and it was very easy to go to CISO and see Borisov. So it worked. And it resulted in a very good judgment, the Zakharkin versus Russia, where actually European Court of Human Rights precisely mentioned that this representative of Zakharkin is a member of an NGO, human rights NGO, such as and she was not allowed to see her client, and it was a violation. Next case, Bugrova versus Russia. I already mentioned this case. So her husband was killed, well, I would say he died in a detention center attached to the police office. So this episode resulted into a number of cases, like a tree of cases. The first of all was a criminal case. A lawyer who was representing Bugrova filed applications to an investigation committee, prosecutor's office, to start investigation, criminal investigation against police officers who didn't provide any medical assistance to the person who was about to die. And then there was a challenging inaction. You mentioned this administrative case, right? Against the 7 or 6 police officers who didn't do anything. They didn't call the ambulance, they didn't give him any assistance, but let him to die in the cell. So,
yes, just a moment. That's maybe a difference between our law system and your system. You said that the administrative case against the 6 officers.
Yeah? Mm-hmm.
In my country, it would be an administrative case against, well, the administrative organ on behalf of which they are working.
Well, they were. I'm simplifying, of course, when I'm saying.
Okay.
But there were many defendants.
Yeah.
Particularly these 6 police officers plus the police station.
Yeah.
Police station.
Yeah.
And I think the Minister of Internal Affairs.
Yeah. Okay.
So, unfortunately, criminal case didn't result in anything. The police, actually, a cellmate of Bugrov was prosecuted and sentenced to a particular sentence for causing damages to Bugrov. Nobody prosecuted police officers. Nobody actually do any investigation in this regard. So challenging inaction resulted in some very interesting judgments. It took a year and a half, I think. And it was a number of hearings. The first decision was that the judge decided that this case, this application is inadmissible because the rights, it's the old story, I was talking about this yesterday, because the rights of Bugrova were not violated. It's the rights of Bugrov who was killed. So, kind of implying that it's only Bugrov who can do something about it. But as you understand, it's impossible. So we went to the higher court with the appeal and referred to the European Convention and some case law saying that Bugrova is an indirect victim and she has a right, she has a standing before the court. This case went back and the same judge finally delivered the judgment on the merits and recognized that the inaction of these six police officers were against the Russian law and the European Convention. And actually, this judge referred to the practice of Article 2 of the European Convention, where there is the meaning of Article 2 is that the state has a positive obligation to take care of a prisoner. If a person is held in a prison, it means it's the whole responsibility about safety of this person is on the state. And if something happens to this person, it's a guilt of the state. So based on the European Convention, this judge delivered a judgment. And another case is challenging normative acts. I already mentioned that yesterday. We found out that this cell where this person was held was so small, not only because of the practice that they put so many inmates into one prison, seven inmates in an 8 square meter cell, but it's also in the law which says that act of the federal government which has a provision that the cell can be as small as 2 square meters per person. So we brought this case before the Supreme Court and Constitutional Court. So, I already mentioned in what are the results of this litigation. There was no decision on the merits by the Supreme Court or the Constitutional Court. It's all now before the attention of the European Court of Human Rights. I would say quite a complicated case. But the interesting fact that while we were working on this case before the Supreme Court and before the Constitutional Court, something happened in the government. So we started this case in 2010. And while we were litigating this case before the Supreme Court and the Constitutional Court and then prepared the application before the European Court in February 2012, and on the day when we filed the case before the European Court, we heard the news. 16th of April, we heard the news that Prime Minister Putin signed a new regulation of the government about the conditions of holding prisoners in these detention centers attached to the police stations. And we looked at this new regulation, which was about to enter into force in May, and we saw not 2 square meters, but 4. So this is, and also I should mention that this particular new regulation signed by Putin didn't change the regulation that we were litigating, that we were trying to change. It's like technicalities. Somehow the law divides two types of these prisons. So the one that we were litigating is 2 square meters, and another type of prisons is 4 square meters. But if we leave it aside and we think about strategic litigation, all this litigation before national district court, before Supreme Court, the Constitutional Court didn't resolve, if you think about it, didn't resolve into any judgment, right? Into any change. It's all now in the European Court. But information reached the administration of the federal government, and they prepared a new draft of the regulation, and they tried to do something to change the situation. They introduced this new regulation which states not just 2 square meters but 4. Of course, it's about also a matter of implementation of this new regulation in practice. Where do you find this 4 square meters for each person? But my point is that this strategic litigation resulted in some change. A prime minister signed a new law, a new regulation. This case I already mentioned, so the tax case, and now the LIFE5 joined this application, and some other people are about to join. I will skip this case, maybe later tomorrow we will have a chance to talk about it. I wanted to talk about the network of cases on domestication of the convention. As we started to talk about this today, in strategic litigation there is one point that you wanted to reach, and you look for cases which can influence, which can help you to reach this goal. So the goal of our NGO was to make the convention more applicable before national courts. So in the 90s, I mentioned yesterday that we were facing this attitude of judges that wouldn't want to even listen about the European Convention. Now maybe they listen, but judges quite often ignore your arguments based on the convention. We had some cases where the only argument that you have, we actually did it in purpose. We didn't use any arguments based on the Russian war, but only on the European Convention. Hearing arguments, submission of memorandum, and then you get a judgment, and there is nothing in the judgment about the European Convention. Why? Like in Bobrova case, all our arguments were about the European Convention. Article 3, inhuman and degrading treatment, the case law, that the rules, European rules about prison conditions, that the floor space should be no less than 7 square meters. And then when you get the judgment of the Supreme Court, there is nothing reflected. So we thought about this situation, how can we deal with this issue? How can we deal with this situation when judges can just simply ignore the arguments and get away with it? So first of all, we started to work in cases and appeal before judges and use arguments only using the convention. So there's no way that the judge will ignore it. But then we also looked at the case law of the European Court and found some possibility of doing this case. If you appear before a judge and your main argument is this, if a judge ignores this argument, it means he or her didn't consider your argument, and it in itself can be a violation of Article 6, right to a fair trial. a fair trial, it means that if you argue something, the judge should listen to your argument and accept it and say why. Give you a reason why the judge accepted your argument. Or if he didn't accept your argument, also give a reason. It's all about reasoning, too. So, we selected with the time a number of cases where the convention was directly applicable, and we put this argument in front of the judges. And in those cases where those arguments were completely ignored, we sent the application before the European Court of Human Rights, and apart from a major main issues that we put before the European Court, like the right to association, Russian Labour Party, that's actually just about to be considered by the European Court, Mikhailova, Bugrova, also in this Burkov case. In all these cases, we try to develop an argument that if we put an argument before a judge and the judge completely ignores it, it's a violation of Article 6 in itself. It's a separate violation. What do we want to do with that? With this? If we get this judgment of the European Court, a Russian government has to execute this judgment of the European Court, pay compensation, and plus introduce general measures. Effective remedy, but a general measure, which can be anything, a change of the practice, or introduce a particular provision in the law, like the judge should reflect, motivate its judgment if a person advances a particular argument. So we see there's a number of cases which are directed to tackle one, apart from other issues, right to association, right to human inhuman and degrading treatment, tax law, property, discrimination. There's also all these cases are has something common in them. Their purpose to deal with the issue of direct or lack of direct application of the European Convention. I shared this with other lawyers, and we actually have a practice of working. This is actually also an element of strategic litigation, because these cases require a lot of work, a lot of research. Each case is like a dissertation, and there's no way one person can deal with all these cases on their own. So we're looking for external help from pro bono law firms, foreign law firms, Russian law firms. So we're successfully working with some law firms on these cases, and this is also a strategic use of resources. An NGO has limited resources, but there are something else you can use. You can find people who can volunteer, who can devote their free time. And actually, these global law firms that help us in this case, they are so much motivated, and they are very good. They are very good lawyers. When you work with them, you have this intellectual pleasure working with them, because everything they prepare, it's thorough research. It's very much just not about it. And you feel, especially if you explain to them why this case, why this Bugrova case are important. Where will it lead to? They have a sense of it, and they work so hard to make this change possible later on. We are running out of time today. I have other cases to share with you, but we're going to talk about this tomorrow. I want you to have a look at this case, I probably will put it on the Facebook links do not disappear. So Bugrova, this case, this is an initial application before the Supreme Court, and this is a decision on inadmissibility of Bugrova's application. They are all in English. You can read them. I will encourage you to read. They are not long, as we say. All the Russian judgments are very short and not motivated. So you will see. And this is the full case file available in Russian and in English. There is an application, preliminary application before the European Court. It's only in Russian. For some reasons, we didn't put the application before the European Court. It's in English on the website, but it's, you probably won't need it. So why I'm asking you to read this? Later on, the day after yesterday, we will try to work on a press release. You will be divided into, I will ask you to divide in small groups and work on press release on the case which is before the European Court of Human Rights. So I will ask you to improvise and work and put some paragraphs together for a journalist. And to give him or her understanding why this case is important, why this person, a journalist, probably will be interested to write about this case. So please have a look, it won't take a lot of your time.
You.
Do you have any questions today? Okay.
Have to read it.
You don't have to read it.
No. I mean, just tell something about it and then stop reading. So that's my apologizing. Is even willing to read this and or with prepare something?
No, just to get familiar with this application and the judgment, a decision of the European Court. Oh, sorry, European Supreme Court.
Okay.
It's just quite interesting. What kind of arguments Bugrova advances, and then how Supreme Court reacts.
Can you tell me whether you have on your website any materials on this case about tax calls?
Yes, you can find it. Search 30% case.
Yeah, yeah. You have an application for the Constitutional Court also. Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Application to the Constitutional Court is in Russian.
Yeah.
And maybe there is also a translation into English. And the application before the European Court too.
Yeah.
Спасибо.